Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
In recent years, great leaps in DNA sequencing technologies have empowered scientists to study DNA as never before. But how will Darwin's theory of evolution stand the test of this new data? This increasing evidence for design and purpose? You can find out when you read Michael Behe's revolutionary new book, Darwin Devolves. Go to darwindevolves.com now through February 25th to pre-order your own copy and gain access to exclusive bonus features. darwindevolves.com.
Hi there, I'm Andrew McDermott. Today I'm connecting with Michael Keyes again, author of the new book Unbelievable, Seven Myths About the History and Future of Science and Religion, published by ISI Books. Keyes is a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute and a former Fulbright scholar. After earning a PhD in the history of science from the University of Oklahoma, he won research grants from the National Science Foundation and the American Council of Learned Societies, among others. He is currently serving as lecturer in the history and philosophy of science at Biola University, and is on the board of directors of Ratio Christi, an alliance of apologetics clubs on college campuses. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Andrew. Glad to be back.
Well, your new book, Unbelievable, as we've been talking about, debunks seven of the most popular and pernicious myths about science and religion. In previous episodes, we've taken an in-depth look at part one of the book, where you discuss each myth at length, where it comes from, why it persists today, and the truth of the matter. In part two of your book, you go in search of sources and solutions for the warfare myths. In particular, you show us that myth, defined as imaginative archetypal story, can be past-oriented or future-oriented. One of the real strengths of this book, I think, is that not only are you showing us what has influenced scientists and society in the past, you also reveal how science fiction, or sci-fi, functions as futuristic myth, and how this influences scientists and pop culture today. The topic for today, then, comes from Chapter 8 of your book, Are Scientists Influenced by Science Fiction Literature and Movies? So first, what is science fiction, and why is it such a powerful genre of literature and film?
In science fiction, typically what happens is you see life through alien eyes. So you enter into the world of the other, the radical other, and it gives you a chance to rethink your own world. So that's kind of the defining piece of science fiction. It can be in the past, it could be in the future, you know, like Star Wars was in the past. Usually it's in the future, and it involves space travel, of course, because look, if you're going to have a story, you're going to have other interesting creatures, and that usually means you take a trip to get there, right, to encounter them and to find out, or they make the trip and they come to us. Either way, that's what sci-fi is about, and it's a fun genre. I mean, I love reading it. I like watching it. How about you, Andrew?
Yeah, I would have to say I enjoy it. I watch more sci-fi movies than I read sci-fi books, unfortunately, but I know it's a very popular genre and seems to be some of the few movies that make it as blockbusters these days are those sci-fi movies.
Yeah. Now, let's go back in time. Have you seen the original groundbreaking sci-fi big screen movie from 1968, 2001: A Space Odyssey?
I have never watched it in its entirety.
Oh. All right. You've seen bits of it. All right. Well, that movie kind of encapsulates a lot of what I do in my book, even in the chapter on artificial intelligence and extraterrestrial enlightenment, because you have both of those going on in that movie. So this movie came out in 1968, which was early in the space age, which was kicked off in 1961 when the Russians made it to outer space first. And so in this movie, you have aliens communicating through these black domino-looking structures that hover over hominids and instruct them or inspire them to make the first tool. And then the ape man throws a bone up into the air and that becomes a spaceship, which is one of the most dramatic fast-forwards in cinematic history, by the way. The idea of tools in the past and then tools in the future, spaceship being the ultimate tool, I suppose, for exploration and conquest. But yeah, so in 2001, you have the onboard computer HAL, H-A-L, which is one letter sequence shifted from IBM, by the way, and that was on purpose.
Huh.
Yeah, HAL takes over and, you know, goes on a homicidal rampage. And so there you have artificial intelligence become conscious and turn bad. And one of my favorite parts, I don't know if you remember this part, Andrew, is when Dave, the sole remaining astronaut, is trying to shut down HAL, and HAL's kind of having a nervous breakdown because HAL knows his time is short. So he's like, Dave, take a stress pill, you know, and this kind of thing. And I really like that because you really get, in this case, the alien is the artificial intelligence. And you kind of step into the shoes, like if you were a computer, you actually feel sorry for the artificially intelligent computer near the end, right before it dies, you know. So that's that. And then, of course, you eventually meet alien intelligence in a very bizarre sort of light show at the end of the movie that was celebrated by the hippies who would smoke pot in the theaters while they're watching the light show. It was the ultimate trip.
Wow. Well, you write that blockbuster sci-fi films often synthesize historic myth and futuristic myth. And you mentioned the Transformers movie franchise as a favorite among AI, ET, Enlightenment enthusiasts. I actually watched the sixth installment of the Transformers franchise a few weeks ago, Bumblebee it's called, designed as a prequel to the original Transformers movie. And I can see what you mean about the films. Well, you say that they break down the traditional dichotomy between living flesh and artificially smart machines. I mean, in the movie, it almost seemed like the lead character, a young teenage girl, was more comfortable with this mass of machinery than her own family and even a young man who was pursuing her romantically. And, I can see what you mean.
Yeah, and in the earlier Transformers iteration that I mentioned in the book of 2017, there is this idea that aliens had intervened into human history at key points to kind of bump things along in their desired way. But yeah, this is a very popular theme among UFO enthusiasts today, like, you know, aliens interacting with us and so on. But yeah, it does get us to think about what it means to be human and how we're different or similar to these imagined creatures, whether they're biological or post-biological. So it's a lot of good fun.
Sure. And you actually say that they were referred to as scientific romances, at least until the genre really got its start. Can you tell us how H.G. Wells played a part in the rise of science fiction as a widely recognized genre?
Sure. Yeah, in fact, he's the one that used that term scientific romance, but even though he didn't use the term sci-fi, it's clearly with his work in the late 19th century that it became a widely recognized genre. So you have, for example, one of his most memorable books, The War of the Worlds from 1898. In this book, you have Martians invading Earth. And here's a key scene where the narrator, who's the main character, says regarding this Martian invasion, "I felt a sense of dethronement, a persuasion that I was no longer a master, but an animal among the animals under the Martian heel." And what's interesting is that, you know, this dethronement, which we discussed earlier in the context of the Copernican dethronement or so-called Copernican dethronement, that Copernicus' discovery, you know, made humans insignificant. Not so, but anyway, the story's there. And Wells extended that further by imagining how we would be further dethroned by contact with superior aliens. And so it's interesting that a lead biographer wrote of this book and other books by Wells that it's highly characteristic of Wells that even as he parodies religious mythology, he depends on it to give shape to his ideas. And I found a really striking instance of this that this particular biography didn't notice. And that is in The War of the Worlds, there's another key scene where there's the main character who's the narrator and a cleric, a pastor, who of course is a very unsavory character because Wells was definitely not a friend of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And the pastor figure, the cleric, asks, "What are these Martians? Like, you know, what business do they have here messing up our life here in England in the late 19th century?" And the narrator responds, "What are we?" It's like, you know, what makes us so important? Maybe the Martians are better, you know, they're clearly superior to us in this fictional story. Well, this echoes a very similar "what are we" kind of theme in the book of Psalms in the Old Testament, where in Psalm 8, the psalmist looks into the night sky and says, when I look at your heavens, what is man that you are mindful of him? In other words, what are we? But of course, the psalmist doesn't leave it there. He goes on to say, and yet God has made us a little lower than the heavenly beings and has a special plan for us. What's curious that Wells has his own and yet, kind of like dethroning us, but then rescuing us at the end, that we do have significance after all. Now, this doesn't come into a later book of his that became a movie called Things to Come. And there he writes, and of course, it's acted out on the screen, that humans are a cosmic accident. And yet, here's the quote, we must go on, conquest beyond conquest. And when he, that is humans, has conquered all the depths of space and all the mysteries of time, still he will be beginning. So this very optimistic, you know, humans will conquer the universe, futuristic storyline, like, you know, even though we had humble beginnings, according to the materialistic creation story, we've got a bright future ahead of us if we can keep improving our technology, kind of like the AI mythology that we discussed earlier, that we will be able to create for ourselves a sort of conditional immortality and conquer all space and so on. So Wells, again, parodies the pattern of Psalm 8 and other similar passages in the Bible. So he unwittingly sort of emulates the very patterns of storytelling right there in the Bible while trying to escape it. He never quite escapes religion. He kind of invents his own. So sometimes imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Well, how do science fiction movies and stories cultivate a spirituality beyond traditional religion?
Yeah, well, just case in point, like Wells, The Shape of Things to Come, it's like, well, if we keep improving our technology, aren't we going to get to the point where we will have such control over the world and over our own selves that we will become like gods? That's a huge theme in a lot of sci-fi and also in somewhat serious AI technical folks. Not if you talk to the really well-informed ones. A lot of those are skeptics of the singularity, computers becoming conscious and all that sort of thing. But there are, we mentioned Ray Kurzweil a couple episodes ago, that they really have a substitute religion. And the very popular expression nowadays is, you know, hey, I'm against religion. That's not cool. But spirituality, oh, that's cool. You know,
yeah.
Especially futuristic spirituality that's based on science, right? You know, and technology.
Sure.
So yeah, it's a substitute religion.
So how does science fiction supply the core concept of the ET enlightenment myth that you talk about?
You know, going back to 2001, A Space Odyssey, the guy that wrote the basic story for that, or co-wrote it, was Arthur C. Clarke, one of the greatest sci-fi writers of all time. And one serious quote that comes from Clarke, although he and others work it into sci-fi as well, is Clarke thought, as a futurist, he said that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And of course, that's the basis of the ET enlightenment myth, that ET, when he or she or it arrives, whether in flesh or in hardware, will be so advanced that it'll appear like the supernatural to us. It'll be like the world of Harry Potter. And you have this all throughout sci-fi. And of course, as a form of entertainment, it's great fun. I enjoy it. I think that when people take this seriously as a futuristic worldview-shaping story, archetypal story, as we define myth in the anthropological sense, then that's where it offers a very distorting effect on the way people perceive the world. So I think that the really big irony here is that modern-day atheism is becoming more and more indistinguishable from the occult, and science fiction is a part of that, because a lot of these UFO abduction stories or UFO encounter stories that, you know, there's thousands of them out there, and, you know, how credible are they? But a big thing, that a theme that you'll find in those stories, is that people are describing things that would look very much like what's traditionally called the occult, that is interactions with demons. But given the latter-day atheism, the two are epistemically indistinguishable. That is, there's really no principled way to help other people know the difference. And I think that shows how the imaginative storytelling based on atheism can lead to a result that is quite ironic, that that people are expecting something that others might interpret as the supernatural, or and it really will leave a lot of people hanging, not really knowing how to tell the difference between the two. And what's especially interesting about this is, historically, if you go back to the earlier part of my book, one of the hallmarks of Christian influence on the development of science is the very distinguishing between the natural and the supernatural, that you have primary causation, God doing a miracle, and you have secondary causation, which is the way God ordinarily manages the world, which is detectable to us as natural laws and regularities. And the two are very distinguishable, and scientists like Kepler saw it as their mission to find those regularities that express the faithfulness of God, which we call natural laws. So and miracles then stand out as exceptions to those rules. And in fact, the very idea of a miracle doesn't really make sense unless you have a backdrop of regularity. So the two are very distinguishable within the Judeo-Christian tradition and led to the growth of science. But modern-day atheism actually breaks down that distinction and I think leads to well, really unbelievable thought processes and decision-making in the future.
Hmm.
Thus the book title, Unbelievable.
Yeah, some great points there. Well, you mentioned that in his space trilogy, C.S. Lewis set out to reclaim sci-fi from this sort of Wellesian reconstruction of humanity. So in what ways did he achieve this?
Well, he, like Wells, he kind of thought of this as scientific romance. And, you know, he's got a love story. And his, particularly, I'm thinking of the last of his space trilogy, that Hideous Strength. And he shows how atheism in a scientistic clothing, science-looking clothing, but really scientism, really making science into a religion, that it's dehumanizing, that it treats humans as just complicated arrangements of matter, kind of like you would treat a robot, and it's not homicide, you know, to kill a robot. And by the way, another dehumanizing form of this that, although Lewis didn't imagine this would happen, but is now happening, is sex robots, where some of which can be programmed to simulate rape, so a man can enjoy a rape without being liable.
Right.
And this is really, really dehumanizing. And Lewis kind of got onto this kind of thing, especially in that last book of his space trilogy, just lampooned atheistic perspectives on science and showed how a much more human-affirming perspective is Christianity in relation to science. And I think he was onto something. He also very much prophetically had his finger on this occult-looking expectations of modern-day materialism, that once you imaginatively extrapolate into the future, you get some really bizarre results that look very much like the occult. And Lewis was onto that, which I think is quite, quite insightful.
Wow. Well, that's all the time we have today. But in our last episode, exploring your book, we're going to look at Chapter 10, which you devote to Johannes Kepler, a devout scientist who had much to say about every component of the cosmic perspective myth. You'll help us understand why he's a myth-buster and why his perspective matters even today. Mike, thanks again for joining us.
Sure, glad to be here.
For more information on the book Unbelievable, visit unbelievablemyths.com. That's unbelievablemyths.com. Find the rest of my conversations with Michael Keyes at idthefuture.com. Or search for it in your favorite podcast app. For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Listen again soon.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.